This edited version of tonight's Proms Plus is hosted by Louise Fryer.
Dr. Daniel Grimley of Oxford University will be joining us shortly to discuss the Fourth Symphony by Carl Nielsen. First, I'm delighted to welcome composer David Matthews, whose new piece, A Vision of the Sea, is receiving its world premiere. David, you were born in London, you still live in London, but you've had a couple of opportunities to live by the sea. Tell us about the importance of the sea to you and where you've experienced it.
Well, I've had a house in Deal in Kent since 1985, and it's become very important to me to be beside the sea. I mean, everyone has their experience of the sea here, and that's it's our national symbol, and everyone has a response to it, I think, a very warm response to it, and often people retire by the sea. When I go there, I go there mostly to work, but I find the sea a great inspiration, not just for this particular piece, which is about the sea, but always. I mean, just to see the sea is the very good beginning of a day. I always go to see the sea before breakfast. I get my best ideas, I think, walking in through various landscapes. And I think of my pieces often as initially as patterns of landscape. You know, I sometimes draw them out with the various climaxes as hills and so on, and plains and things. I'm going to get an idea of the form.
Well, that seems like a very good time. Thank you, David. We look forward to listening to your vision of the sea this evening. But it seems like a very good time to introduce Dr. Daniel Grimley. He's a man who knows all about connections between music and landscape. He teaches in the Faculty of Music at Oxford. And cultural geography, and in particular the music of Scandinavia, are his big things. One of his recent books is called Carl Nielsen and the Idea of Modernism. So he's also the perfect person to join me to discuss the work that ends tonight's prom, Nielsen's Fourth Symphony. I wonder if you'd just like to pick up on this concept of musical landscapes.
It's really interesting to think about Nielsen and landscape. It's a recurrent thread in his music and also in the reception of his work. And I think we have to go back to the very start of his life. He was born in a very modest working-class family out in the middle of the Danish countryside. And for people who haven't been to Denmark, it actually looks rather like the Kent or Suffolk coast. It's low-lying, often quite coastal. You have this strong sense of the interlocking patterns of sea and land. And he was part of a generation of artists and writers who were concerned with ways of talking about and aestheticizing the Danish landscape scenically. So towards the end of his life, Nielsen writes about the Danish landscape in rather idealistic terms. He talks about going to the island where he's born, Funen, and listening. And he says that Funen has a special sound, and that even the trees talk with a particular Funsk lilt, almost as though they have their own language. And I think what's interesting there is the way that he shifts from this idea of landscape as being mainly a visual phenomenon to something that's more sonic or inhabited or dwelt within. And I think that actually that experience of growing up in a landscape with a very close feeling for its texture and grain is something that was really formative on his development as a composer and a musician.
And do we hear that in this particular piece, in the Fourth Symphony?
Well, I'd like to think there are various points in this symphony where we can hear the landscape breaking through. There's a remarkable passage in the middle of the first movement where the music just seems to stop. You have a long pedal in the cellos and basses, and then a set of woodwinds in thirds playing this almost a stylized bird call over that. And you feel that at that moment that the landscape is kind of breathing around you. But there are other moments when you feel as though you're caught up in some kind of geological process, as though the landscape's being formed and shaped by unseen forces that you cannot quite contain, but you can feel their impact upon you. And that's a much more dynamic sense of being out in the landscape, I think, rather than just standing there and looking at it or listening to it.
He wrote this piece in 1914, which was a rather difficult time for celebrating your country.
That's right. Well, this is, in one sense, a war symphony. So this is a piece that draws on a lot of these images of conflict and violence and of things moving apart and the friction, the distance that creates. Denmark, of course, wasn't involved directly in the war. We have no evidence that Nielsen thought he was writing a piece in response to the war. But for an artist who was engaged with a European cultural scene as he was, it was impossible not to be moved in some sense by the political tumult that was happening around him. And I think this is a remarkable piece because in some ways it's a real vindication of the power of music to offer you some kind of resolution. And to have that sort of gesture at that moment of extreme crisis and bloodshed, I think took a very particular kind of courage. It's a very brave, if contingent, vision.
It starts off fairly chaotic, doesn't it? Take us through the opening.
Let's just listen to the opening bars of this symphony, because it's a real barnstorming way to begin. Nielsen has such a great way with openings. No one begins a symphony quite like Carl Nielsen does. And I think this is interesting because symphonies are meant to start with some kind of bold, confident gesture that gives you a sense of stability, which then becomes a point of departure. But here you already find yourself in the middle of some kind of process so that you feel that you're actually caught up in the excitement of creating this world around you. You feel as though the forces are already in the air sweeping you along. And that's really, I think, an important clue to the work's title, which is one of the most difficult words in the English and indeed Danish languages, the inextinguishable. Well, in Danish, it's the uslulia, which is quite a mouthful. And it's a way of talking about, it literally means that which cannot be quenched or extinguished. And what Nielsen's trying to capture here is some sense of the creative shaping of the material, the excitement of generating this at first chaotic symphonic vision. It's a very dynamic sense of the world in motion around you.
It's very much a noun, isn't it? Not an adjective.
That's right. It's a doing word. It's about that process of bringing things into some kind of sense of coherence.
And where does he take us next?
Well, then we have almost the polar opposite. So you've had this explosive beginning with its distinctive timpani signal, a tritone, and we'll come back to that later in the symphony. But then we have this second subject group, which is the complete opposite. Let's just hear a quick snatch of that. So you get that second subject twice. When you first hear it, it's a kind of lyrical idea on woodwind and then strings. And for me, that always suggests some kind of image of the Danish fields in late summer. There's a sort of golden light that just suffuses the orchestral texture. And then you get it transformed as this glowing apotheosis idea. And that's really the symphony's point of arrival, and it's part of a tonal process that's going on in this work as well. We hit A major for the first time, and A major for Nielsen is quite often associated with freedom, with a sense of expansiveness, of a feeling of liberation, and this is really one of the expressive focal points around which the symphony revolves.
Is that the kind of opening you would want, David? I mean, how do you approach beginning a symphony?
How do I approach beginning a symphony? Well, all my symphonies seem to begin in different ways. They usually don't begin in a state of turbulence like that, although it's an interesting idea since I'm thinking about another symphony at the moment. They usually tend to begin, well, they have begun with quite a simple and sometimes quite long idea, which is then gradually developed and gradually becomes more complex as it goes on. But I love this symphony. I think it's wonderful. And I love the way it achieves stability finally out of all this chaos. It's interesting that Sibelius was also writing his fifth symphony at the same time, wasn't he? And he achieves a similar kind of heroic conclusion, going through a great process of disturbance, and though there's much more in Nielsen than in Sibelius, I think.
But he gives us this kind of sense of hope, doesn't he, almost from the start?
That's right. I think this is what's remarkable about this symphony, is that it's so wide-ranging, and you feel that these are forces that cannot possibly be reconciled, and yet there is always a sense of the energy or the creative spirit behind the music. And I think for Nielsen, as long as that is there, then there is hope for the world. And that, again, is what the title is really meant to be pointing us toward.
And then he takes us somewhere different again for the second movement.
Yes, the second movement isn't really a scherzo, it's more an intermezzo, but it's an intermezzo that takes us to a completely different world. And it feels almost as though we've stepped back in time to the late 18th century of Mozart and Haydn. And Nielsen was a great admirer of Mozart, and we can imagine it almost as a sort of little scene from a comic opera or a classical symphony. It's a delicate little piece for woodwind and strings that's half minuet, half a little gavotte, and it's worlds away from the turbulence and the hope of the opening movement.
Let's have a listen to it. So where is he taking us with this?
It's a very interesting gesture. It's interesting to think about Nielsen in comparison with another contemporary symphonist like Gustav Mahler. When you have that kind of almost neoclassical gesture in Mahler, it always has a sense of distance, of being Irenized somehow. This is music you cannot quite hear straight. And I think Nielsen's very different to that. I think this music gives us a sense of groundedness or a sense of home. There's a sense of inner peace and quiet about it. So it's really there in order to amplify that sense of contrast that we've already experienced in aspects of the first movement. So it's really trying to express the whole world in a symphony.
And then where are we heading? I mean, it's all going to go horribly wrong, isn't it? You can't help thinking at this stage. It's all just a little bit too calm.
This simply is in four movements, but they play without a break, so you barely have a moment to draw breath. But one of the useful ways of thinking about this piece is to imagine it in two halves, and the first half is that turbulent first movement and then the gentle Mozartian intermezzo. Then the second half begins with what's in fact a slow movement, the third movement, and this sets out to rebuild the symphony almost from scratch. So we begin with a very, very long melodic line on the strings that I think points to the influence of Sibelius on Nielsen's approach to orchestration. And this immediately suggests a sense that there are darker clouds on the horizon.
Thank you.
captures something of Britain for me, that arresting...
It does, doesn't it?
...string sound.
Yes.
It's a remarkably expansive sound just from one very simple melodic idea. Yes. And then it forms the basis for actually almost 10 minutes of continuous melodic music. It's really the most remarkable example of composing out from a very, very simple initial idea and then just letting the melodic lines expand, almost like you're moving towards some kind of distant horizon. And then as we build this music, we get a more hymn-like chorale passage that's first on the strings and then on the brass, and it builds up to the most tremendous sense of climax. Let's just listen to that. This is part of the symphony's tonal journey again. This is a real breakthrough for the symphony's journey towards its concluding point. This is E major, which recaptures the end of the first movement. And if in the first movement A major had symbolized a certain kind of freedom or expansiveness, the addition of that extra sharp to the key signature, four sharps rather than just three, gives this music a much brighter, even more confident tone. And you get those triumphant sort of timpani triplets as you reach that key at that moment. But this is no conclusive victory at this point. We're far too early in the symphony for that. And there's much more terrifying drama to come.
Mostly provided by the timpani.
Yes, well, I told you to listen out for those timpani tritones at the very start of the work. And they've been shattering it all the way through this piece. And then the finale begins with a sense of confidence, as though it's going to resolve everything in some kind of straightforward heroic gesture. But the timpani come back with those tritones, and Nielsen introduces a second set of timpani that he writes should be placed at the far edge of the orchestra, near the audience. So they're meant to be right in your eye line and ear line. And they have a dramatic duel with the original first set of timpani that tries to disrupt the whole flow of the symphony. Let's just listen to their first entry. We're back into A major, and the symphony is almost done, but not quite, and I won't spoil the ending for you before you hear it tonight. And of course, I think it's tempting to go back to that idea of this being a war symphony and hear that timpani duel as in some way an attempt to capture the sound of the guns. But I think actually that's to misread what Nielsen is trying to do here, because he doesn't like program music to be that literal. He doesn't like the idea of program music at all. I think this is rather an attempt to try and distill the idea of the symphony as a drama of conflict and friction and dissonance, and to crystallize it in its most elemental and pure form, so that when you finally emerge out of that conflict, you have a real sense of the possibility of some kind of resolution.
And how was it received here in the UK? What did we think of Nielsen then and now?
Well, that's an interesting question. I think Nielsen is a composer whose star is still rising, And this symphony was first played in London in 1923, but it's only recently entered the repertoire. So I think he's a composer whose time has yet to come. But I am struck by some of the similarities I hear between what Nielsen's trying to do in this symphony and also in his fifth, with aspects of what Vaughan Williams was doing in his later symphonies, and also what Tippett was doing in a work like the Second Symphony. Mm. That idea of the symphony as an ethical process or journey is one that I think has appealed to a whole generation of later British symphonists.
Yes, indeed. I mean, I grew up with Nielsen, certainly the Third, Fourth and Fifth Symphonies, which I got to know as a teenager. And at the same time, I was also very, very impressed by Sibelius' symphonies. And they've really helped me, I think, become a symphonist in the sense that they renewed the symphony at a time when a lot of people were saying that it was finished. Some people said that, you know, Mahler was the end of the symphony. Well, it's just not so. And I think there's tremendous vitality in Nielsen's symphonies. And I'm a great admirer of the way he's able to use tonality in a fresh way, again, at a time when a lot of people said that it was dying.
David Matthews and Dan Grimley, thank you.
Thank you.
Louise Fryer introduced that edited version of tonight's Proms Plus, which took place earlier this evening at the Royal College of Music. It was produced by Helen Garrison.